Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And welcome back from your holiday in Hawaii.
Aloha. Yeah. Aloha. And Mali Hala, as they say, which is thank you in Hawaii. Yeah, it was the word I keep falling back on all the time is seductive. What a seductive place. And we've not been there before, but you know, you get up in the morning at 64 degrees, and then you go to bed at night and it's 72 degrees.
And then you came home to 28.
And a little snow on the ground. But it was a great experience because you could literally, and we did, you go up 11,000 feet to near the top of a volcano and see the snow cap up there.
Mm-hmm.
2 hours later, we're down in the rainforest and the beaches and the pounding waves and the people. It's such a really mix of cultures and ideas and thoughts and pride.
Mm-hmm.
We just enjoyed it much more than I ever thought, frankly. I had always kind of resisted going to Hawaii because I thought it would just be a hot beach, but there's just a lot more there. Went to about 8 or 10 different gardens, and we'll talk about several of those experiences.
Yeah, we'll look forward to those coming up in the next couple of weeks on Homegrown. But today, we get the first leg of your trip, Bob. Where will you be?
Actually, it's where Hawaii began. It's the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park.
Okay.
I got to watch a lava flow, which was a religious experience. You don't quite get to see it, but it's close enough. But I talked to a ranger named B.J. Horvat, and then a division of resources management guy named David Benitez about how Hawaii was formed. Then you're walking on lava that's 20 years old, and the plants are coming back out of the rock, and you get a real sense of what prehistoric life.
And just like the regenerative spirit of the earth.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it was
great.
It was invigorating for me.
Great. So we look forward to that today on Homegrown. I'm also going to have a conversation with Victor Marullo. He's an attorney who specializes in tree and neighbor law. How about that? Did you even know that there was a body of law that existed that's called tree and neighbor law?
No, we just break out our chainsaws and divide it up in the past.
Yeah, no kidding. Things have changed,
Bob. Yeah, I guess.
In the litigious society that we live in, now there's a need for tree and neighbor law.
Yeah.
But I was interested in what the legal responsibility is, you know, for all of us, really, especially as the cleanup continues after the ice storm from late January. And then the other windstorm, you were still out of town.
Yeah.
But we had another windstorm in early February on a Wednesday. Actually, one of our trees fell and snapped a power line, so we took out the whole road. Sorry, everybody. Sorry, neighbors.
Uh-oh.
You know, so it just keeps going on and on and on.
Yeah, I know.
And everything that's left behind, you know, whose responsibility lies with what? So I figured I'd go to the source. So Victor's going to help us sort through some of that. You know, we could have talked much longer about other issues, too, but we're going to sort of stick with the responsibilities that you and I have as neighbors, et cetera. So please stick with us. I think some good information today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Actually, I was walking around the yard after I got back, and I have some really good help, some people we hired to help clean the things up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just optimistic again. I mean, I missed the big windstorm, thank God. I was here for the ice. But 90% of what I had, I still have, and I'm just hanging on to that.
Yeah.
You know, it's bent a little bit, and it's going to come back, and I got some holes I got to patch. But by and large, just like the plant life, I'm just going to stick with it and keep going and regenerate myself and my garden.
Yeah, after the initial shock, I feel pretty much the same way. But at this point, it's the organization, you know, because we have 18 acres. It's the organization of what's been left.
Yeah, right.
So I've staged, like, piles of debris along the driveway, along the road, along areas where a chipper can actually come.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll just toss the stuff in. We want the chips.
Right.
So, you know, we can use them. Other stuff, Bob, I bought a chainsaw.
Whoa.
Went up to Cottrell's in Simpsonville and bought a steel chainsaw. Andy knows how to use
it,
carefully and properly and wears safety equipment.
Right.
I'm toying with the idea of having him teach me how to do a little bit.
Sure.
But they do make me nervous. But we now own our own chainsaw. So the rest of the stuff we'll just sort of plug away as we can. We do have to have some arborists come in and do some cleaning up with bucket trucks, hardcore, proper pruning of really big trees, you know, and then taking out a couple of other really big trees too. So, you know, patience and trying to be optimistic about the opportunity. But for now, I'm staging so that everything can operate smoothly once help arrives. How about that?
As I said, I've got great neighbors, and by and large, if something falls across our property lines, we break out our chainsaws and solve the problem. But it doesn't always work that way.
It doesn't always work that way, and things have increasingly got complicated, I think, along those lines. And that's why I sought out Victor Marullo to talk to him about the issues. Attorney Victor Marullo is a partner in Marullo, Reister & Swinford, a law firm in Columbus, Ohio. One of Victor's specialties is arboriculture and neighbor law. Typically, their clients are arborists, landowners, public utilities, and municipal governments. He's also the author of Trees in the Law and the co-author of Arboriculture in the Law. Victor, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for having me.
Certainly. Give us a little primer on tree law. What's the foundation of the body of law?
Basically, if we look just quickly at the law that we have in the United States, we find that we have three main sources of law. We have fundamental law, which is our constitutional rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, our Bill of Rights, which are fundamental rights upon which the sovereign, which would be the state or federal government, could not impinge or reduce those rights without just cause. And then we have written law, and all the states, including Kentucky, have passed a number of statutes. Some of those statutes deal with tree law. For example, you have a statute in Kentucky that if you enter upon the land of another without permission and you take someone's tree down or injure someone's tree, you could be liable for three times the damages which you caused that person plus attorney fees. So there's written laws. And then finally, the main base of law that we have dealing with trees is what is known as common law. Common law developed over many, many years, and we can even go back to England. We adopted much of our legal theory from English common law. And common law is where a magistrate or judge hears the facts, reaches a decision, and then he passes that decision on to other magistrates or judges, and if they like that particular decision, it becomes law of precedent. And that's what happened in England. They had the king sent out 12 magistrates, and they all wrote a circuit. And every year they would stop at different places, and at the end of the year they'd all come together. They'd explain all the cases they had because they kept notes. And then they would indicate what decision they rendered. And if the other magistrates liked the decision, they adopted that decision for same or similar cases. Well, we do the same thing in the United States, except we do it on a state-by-state basis.
That's what I was going to ask. When we look at those three different areas, you know, ultimately whose authority? I mean, is it local and state, or is it mostly state?
Well,
or depends.
If you have trial courts and then appellate courts and then your Supreme Court in Kentucky, you start out by your trial courts make decisions, and they are required to find same or similar decisions on issues that may be before them. And they usually follow the law of precedent, what has been decided before they try to apply it.
Right.
Your appeals court can uphold that, or they can change it and say, well, now, things have changed in modern society, and they have across the United States have changed, and common law does change basically frequently across the United States in various cases. And in tree law, I'll give you a couple examples in a few minutes.
Sure.
And then if the Supreme Court rules on that same issue that started in the trial court, and the Supreme Court of Kentucky reaches a decision on that issue, that decision binds the entire state.
Okay.
So if a municipal court reaches a decision, it usually is up for grabs. Any municipal court can change it, but if the appeals court for that area reaches a decision, it binds that district, and then if the Supreme Court reaches a decision,
it
binds the state.
Yes. Okay, I see. So when we do look at that process, then what kinds of precedents have been reset, if you will? what's the common sense of it all?
One of the things that every person needs to know, and one of the first questions you need to ask when you deal with trees, is who owns the tree? And how does the law resolve it? The common law says, and Kentucky has adopted this along with many other states, that where the trunk of the tree emerges out of the ground determines who owns the tree. Therefore, if the trunk of the tree where it emerges out of the ground is entirely on your property, you are the sole owner of that tree. But if the trunk of the tree emerges out of the ground, is on your property and someone else's property, then there is co-ownership or common ownership of that tree. More than one person owns that same tree.
So does there have to be more or less of a percentage on one side or the other, or even just a little bit on the other side, you have the co-ownership of it?
No. No, not under the current common law. Now, now courts may at some point in the future decide that we should look at proportionate liability and proportionate ownership and maintenance costs. But I can tell you, for example, in the state of Illinois, a case, Ridge of versus Blaha, came out, whereby only 5 inches of an elm tree, where the trunk emerged from the ground, actually, you know, over the years, the elm tree grew into the boundary line. It actually didn't start off on the boundary line, but it became a boundary line tree because 5 inches of the trunk where it emerges from the ground had grown on to the Ridge's property. The Blahas wanted to remove the tree because there was a lot of litter from the tree. It was disrupting their walks and actually was planted on their property originally. But the court said no. It is commonly owned, and as long as it's a healthy tree, neither party may damage, destroy, or remove that tree without the consent of the other. And the court further held that ownership of that tree was equal, even though there was only 5 inches on one side.
Okay, so that's the precedent for now.
Yeah, the ownership of that tree is equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that means equal for liability purposes. That means equal for, if it has to be removed, equal for liability removal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone gets injured from a boundary line tree, both you and your neighbor may have liability if the tree was a hazardous tree.
So that's part of this whole scenario as well. And it was one of the things that I got thinking about in light of the storms that we've had, from wind storms back in September and then the ice storm of January. And there are so many like potentially hazardous situations everywhere you look.
Right.
You know, and who is... When it's state and local property and private property and stuff's just everywhere, you know, how do you weigh
there's
liability
more,
there?
The common law has answered all these questions. Now, let's go to the next common law concept I think you need to know when you're dealing with trees.
All right.
Is that in an urban area, in any area which is incorporated, so any municipality which is incorporated, is by law an urban area. In an urban area, the owner of a tree has the duty to inspect each and every tree on his or her property to determine if the tree is a hazard tree or a healthy tree. And if they determine the tree is a hazardous tree, they're under a duty at common law to remove that tree. And failure to remove that tree, and if someone gets injured or property is damaged, they are liable for the damages resulting from their failure to remove a hazardous tree. So, not only do we determine who owns the tree, now we know that the owner of the tree has a duty, just like you own a home, you have a duty to inspect to see that the home doesn't deteriorate, or you have a duty to be sure the maintenance on the home is kept up so that you won't be injuring your neighbor. Well, that's the same rule we have with tree. You have a duty to be sure that tree is a healthy tree and not a hazardous tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next question is, how do you know if a tree is a hazardous tree?
Right.
Well,
who does the inspection?
Courts say that any tree that has a structural defect of the tree itself or any part thereof is a hazardous tree. And our duty when we inspect a tree is to look at the tree to see if we see anything which may lead a reasonable person to believe that that tree may have some issues. And if it does, we're under a duty to cause a further inspection of that tree, either ourselves or we can hire a professional. There are so many professional arborists out there now to recognize issues and to be able to resolve problems. And anyone who has trees which are mature trees probably would be well served from time to time to have at least an arborist come and evaluate the condition of the trees if they have any question in their own mind.
So, Victor, I'm a little confused. I can see where a certified arborist would be, you know, an expert witness as such. But how would I qualify going out and inspecting my trees and determining that, oh, no, there's no structural defect here, so my trees are safe. But my neighbor says, wait a minute, I'm worried about that tree. You know, how does that stand up,
right,
you know, under that common law?
All right. If a homeowner goes out and looks at his trees, and he notices nothing which would lead him to believe that there is something wrong with the tree, then maybe that homeowner has done his or her duty in terms of the inspection. But if we can produce evidence that the tree has had a history of large branches falling out, that there is a lot of sap that's seeping that you can see with your eyes, mm-hmm. that it has a crack, a large codominant stem which is cracking, if we can see evidence, and any person, any reasonable person looking at that tree could have seen evidence of large cavities or other evidence that the tree may have problems, then the homeowner, by just only saying, well, I looked at the tree, looked all right to me, cannot escape liability because there were visual signs which would lead a reasonable person to believe that there may be other issues going on in that tree. Mm-hmm. And we recently had one here in Ohio that where the tree fell and took someone's roof out. And the woman says, well, I never saw the owner of the tree, who was a lady, said, I never saw anything wrong with that tree ever. But then when we started to dig in the history, we found that the limbs had been falling, mm-hmm. and there are signs when you look at the tree, large cavities in the tree. We could see signs that an ordinary person would have recognized that there were some issues, some serious issues going on with that tree, mm-hmm. and she was held to be liable, of course, her insurance company, to be liable for the payment of the damages that occurred to the neighbor's property.
All right. So what about trees that are owned not by private landowners, homeowners, tree owners, but along state easement areas and local easements? Do they also come under the same?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. If a city owns a tree in an urban area and they fail to do a reasonable inspection and they fail to discover through due diligence a defective tree, and that tree falls and injures someone because it is a hazardous tree, which means it has a structural defect, then they are held to the same liability standards as an individual. Mm-hmm. And it happens quite frequently that cities are held to those standards. Most cities now have an urban forester, a staff of trained arborists to go out and look and inspect these trees and to make them aware of any dangerous trees that ought to be removed. And furthermore, many cities receive phone calls from their citizens or residents telling them that there are a number of trees that need to be dealt with. So that's how the word gets out.
Mm-hmm. How does the act of God argument play a role here?
Well, rarely is there an act of God. Okay. There can be acts of God. When an act of God such as a hurricane is so severe and is the exclusive cause of the damages, then that is a defense. Mm-hmm. But normally, even in a windstorm like we had last night or mm-hmm. the night before, that's not an unusual occurrence to occur in these areas.
Right.
And so normally we're going to say, yeah, that was a bad windstorm, but the second thing we're going to do is we're going to look to see if there is anything which would lead a reasonable person to believe that the tree may have been defective already. Mm-hmm. And if it was defective already, they cannot use the wind as an excuse to escape liability.
What about trespassing and such? If you're on someone else's property and get hurt by a tree that is, you know, marked for failure and everybody recognizes it,
right,
are you still going to get in trouble even though this person was not welcome on your property?
Okay. Now, the common law, and trespass is a common law concept, mm-hmm. if you trespass on another person's property without permission to do so, you have committed a civil trespass. And common law says that the owner of the property owes no duty of care to a trespasser. So if a trespasser gets injured, we owe him no duty of care. And if that's the case, then the trespasser has to sustain his or her own damages.
Mm-hmm. Is ignorant bliss at all in any of this? I would suspect that a lot of people don't really know the laws. I mean, I don't know if, what it's like up in Columbus, Ohio, Victor, where you all are, but it seems as though there are a great many trees out in public spaces and private spaces that are hazardous. Is it your feeling that generally people do not know their responsibilities?
Well, Municipalities certainly are quite educated in today's society about what their duties and responsibilities as to the maintenance of trees in the urban area.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people who have no real knowledge of that. However, when something happens and their insurance company says, well, you knew you had a dead tree, therefore we're not going to cover you for insurance, you're personally liable, and the word gets out to other people that you can become personally liable, well, then they begin to learn that they mm-hmm. have a duty to maintain their property, which includes trees.
Because mm-hmm. yeah. it seems to me that there's a great deal of confusion between landowners and municipalities in terms of, and you could probably explain this a little bit better, the difference between easements and the concept of eminent domain. But you know, that verge on the other side of the sidewalk, you know, for some instances, it's the property owner's responsibility. And then in other instances, there's some easement issues and it's the, you know, municipal responsibility. It's sort of like if the tree falls in your yard, you got to get it cleaned up. But if it falls in the street, the city gets it, cleans it up. Can you explain that sort of muddled?
Well, there is this muddled, rule.
Uh-huh.
The rule is if a healthy tree does fall or any part thereof falls, and it falls on someone else's property, the property upon the land upon where the limb falls is responsible to remove the limb, because it was a healthy limb. There is no liability. If I have a healthy tree and a limb falls out of that tree for whatever reason,
okay,
whether it be a storm or whether it just be natural, and it falls on your property, my tree was a healthy tree.
That was the unforeseen sort of.
Yeah, I'm uh-huh. not liable. Your insurance company would have to, if any damages were sustained on your property, your insurance company would be the one who would have to take care of those.
Okay.
However, if you could establish that the tree, my tree, was a hazardous tree in any respect, then my insurance company and I would be liable to pay any damages that you sustained.
And there doesn't have to be any sort of like documentation of that. Do you know what I mean? Like I telling your neighbor, I think you have a dangerous tree there,
yeah,
and then it falls in your yard or on your garage, well, you know, does there have to be some sort of documentation other than the fact that you could clearly see or that there was a history of that tree failing in some form or fashion in the past or that potential to fail because of decay?
Right. Well, everything always depends on the circumstances and the facts
certainly,
of the case.
Certainly.
But certainly if someone raises an issue as to whether a tree is a healthy or hazardous tree on my property, the smart thing for me to do would be to hire either a consulting arborist or a certified arborist mm-hmm. to come out and give me a written report on my tree
mm-hmm.
so that I can say I acted reasonably when I got this information and the arborist has indicated my tree is not a hazardous tree. That would certainly lessen or mitigate my damages.
Okay.
There are two ways a person knows whether they have a hazardous tree. They can have actual knowledge. That's true with municipalities, too. Someone calls up and says, hey, there's something wrong with this tree. It's dropping large limbs or it looks dead to me. That's actual knowledge. And the second way a person can have knowledge of the condition of a tree is what we call constructive knowledge. That means if a person acts with due diligence in inspecting his or her own tree, including municipalities, if they use due diligence, they would have discovered that the tree was a hazardous tree.
Mm-hmm.
And if they discovered the tree was a hazardous tree, then they would be required to remove it. So you can either have actual knowledge, someone telling you,
mm-hmm.
or you can have constructive knowledge when you fail to use due diligence. Mm-hmm. Due diligence would lead a reasonable person to discover that there is a hazardous condition on that tree.
And there's a whole lot of unreasonable people out there, though, aren't there?
There certainly are.
I mean, because that's the thing. It's like there's these words, you know, reasonable, due diligence. And so often people are unreasonable when it comes to these things because it's going to cost them a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
you know? So are there ways in which people can seek help if they feel like they can't afford something? Or is it just you got to do it or else you could get in trouble?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Many municipalities are offering some assistance. Some, like in Milwaukee, they even will be willing to come out and examine trees on private property, and that's within their scope of their employment.
Mm-hmm.
that they can do that on behalf of the city because their ordinance permits it, and that would help an average homeowner from always having to rely or pay an arborist to come out if they suspect there might be a problem or an issue. That's a benefit that they're having.
Mm-hmm.
Universities, companies, many companies will come out and inspect trees without any charge,
mm-hmm.
to see if they can get business from you if they find
right.
something else wrong,
right.
and that would be of some benefit. But there are a number of avenues, I think, that are available to the homeowner if they have limited funds and have concerned about their trees, that they can get assistance.
Mm-hmm. What's your best advice to homeowners? I guess, you know the common law and your municipal ordinances and such
mm-hmm.
With trees. But, I mean, you know, what's your best advice and most reason, you know, to convince people to be that reasonable, diligent person?
Most of the time, we don't have a lot of problems with the trees falling and injuring or killing someone unless the tree's really in bad shape, and you certainly can observe that. But we do have problems with the overhanging branches between the neighbors, and even though you have a right in Kentucky, you can go to your boundary line and trim those overhanging branches off the tree to your boundary line. Oftentimes, this upsets your neighbor. Maybe we ought to have a little more communications between each other and talk things out and see if we can work out issues before they become issues, especially with trees that are near the property lines. That's my best advice. Communicate.
Thank you, Victor. We appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much.
Uh-huh. Attorney Victor Marullo is a partner in Marullo, Reister & Swinford, a law firm in Columbus, Ohio. One of Victor's specialties is arboriculture and neighbor law. Typically, their clients are arborists, landowners, public utilities, and municipal governments. He's also the author of Trees and the Law and co-author of Arboriculture and the Law. Of course, for more information on Victor Marullo and trees, people, and the law, please see our website at wfpl.org. And there was no ice for Bob on holiday in Hawaii. We get an introduction to the islands after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown and Aloha. This is Bob Hill continuing his Somebody Had to Do It tour of the Hawaiian Islands. I had a wonderful experience last night. I walked out on 20-year-old lava, which is nothing in terms of Earth's geology, and looked off to the right, and there was this wonderful plume of smoke, and as this got darkened and the sun set finally, right behind the plume actually, there's this wonderful red glow, and what I like to think was red lava popping up in the air. That might just be nonsense, but you come this far, you want to see red lava. Anyway, I've got two men with me today that can explain a lot about the volcanoes and then the plant life that I saw coming back in this 20-year-old rock, which was kind of amazing. I'm speaking with B.G. Horvat, who's a park ranger at the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, and then David Benitez, an ecologist with the National Park Service, who spends his life studying the plants that are coming back on the rock and how to restore the Hawaiian Islands to what they were. So it's fun being with these guys. BG, welcome to Homegrown.
Aloha.
Okay, what was I seeing last night? Tell me a little bit about the history of the volcanoes and how the Hawaiian Islands got here.
Well, the Hawaiian Islands, they originate from a hot spot, which if you're not familiar with what that is, a hot spot is a thin piece of Earth's crust. On average, our Earth's crust is approximately 50 miles thick. But right now on the planet Earth, there's about 30 or so spots where the Earth's crust is actually less than 10 miles thick. Hawaii is one of these places. As a matter of fact, geologists at Hawaii Volcano Observatory have come to find that the Hawaiian hotspot is an area where the Earth's crust is about 6 to 8 miles thick. So this is a pretty thin area, obviously, and especially when you're thinking about what's inside our planet. Hot magma. And this is some material that's so hot that it can melt metal and rock. And as with anything that's hot, it moves quite fast. It convects through our planet. At any rate, with a weak spot in our Earth's crust, like what you find here in Hawaii, this hot material, you can maybe easily understand how this material would plume up this thin area of Earth's crust and begin to leak out. And over an immense amount of time, which is hard for us humans to understand, because if we are lucky, we'll live to be about 100, this material will continuously keep leaking and leaking and leaking and building up and building up. And before you know it, all this buildup, well, it will pop up out of the ocean. It creates a brand new Hawaiian island.
Okay, from what I've read, the universe is maybe 13 billion years old, and the Earth itself, 6, 8, 9 billion years old, who's counting? But the Hawaiian Islands are really very, very young in terms of geology.
This island that you've come to visit, the Big Island of Hawaii, is the youngest. It's still developing, really. There is a new Hawaiian island that's forming right now about 30 miles off the coast of South Point here, and that's named Lo'ihi for now. But by the time it surfaces the ocean, geologists think that'll take place in the next 10,000 to 100,000 years from now. Of course, that could change.
And how old are the Hawaiian Islands, oldest and the youngest?
The youngest Hawaiian island is, I guess, Lo'ihi, if you're looking at what's forming right now. But really, this island that we can see and experience is believed to be yet less than a million years old, approximately 750,000 years old. But if you go all the way up the whole archipelago of Hawaii, as far northwest as you can, out there you'll find atolls that are, and actually seamounts, that are around 45 million years old.
There's two different kinds of lavas, I understand. Let's talk about those two different kinds, then we'll talk about the recent eruptions here on the island.
Okay. Yeah, there are two different types of lava, A'a and Pahoehoe. Pahoehoe is typically what comes out of these volcanoes when they erupt. We have shield volcanoes here in Hawaii. Pahoehoe lava is a highly viscous lava. It's a very hot lava. It's anywhere from 1700 to 2400 degrees Fahrenheit in temperature. It has a lot of gas in it. And it's much more liquid, I suppose, with its viscosity than the A'a lava. The A'a lava, many people that see that for the first time might see a field off in the distance as they're driving the roads around here. And to many people, they say it looks like the Oreo cookie crumbs kind of sprinkled along the landscape. And that lava is a lava that's a little cooler than, well, actually, it's a lot cooler than Pahoehoe. It's about 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit or so. And it has lost a lot of the gas that Pahoehoe has. And therefore, as this flow with that temperature and less gas is flowing, it will basically trip over itself and spit as it rolls.
Okay, then the recent eruptions, I, of course, witnessing part of one this week, but the last couple hundred years for sure we know about, so kind of catch us up on contemporary lava flows here in the Hawaiian Islands.
There's been a lot of eruptive activity in the last 200 years around here. Mauna Loa averages an eruption every 10 years if you look at the last 200 years of just that volcano. It hasn't erupted since 1984. Kilauea has had many eruptions almost continuously in that last 200 years with just a few pauses in between. And that's just going to really show the age of these volcanoes. I mean, for instance, this volcano here at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, Kilauea, she's the youngest volcano on the island. It's been erupting every day since January 3rd, 1983, for the most part. So that's over 26 years of constant lava flow. Good example, this volcano, 350,000 years old, is like a baby. It's like you could compare it to a six-year-old child. She's got her whole life ahead of her. So really, this volcano will be erupting just about every single day for the rest of our lives, and probably for the next generations to come. And Mauna Loa, living in the prime of her life with all her eruptions. We haven't seen her erupt in a while, like I said, so we're kind of waiting to see what happens with that.
How much warning do you get? I mean, you got to get out of here. You got 10 minutes, 2 weeks, 10 days. What's the deal?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. With all the science that's out there and everybody that researches these volcanoes constantly, we have basically three things that geologists look at. The gas geochemistry, the types and the amounts of gas that are coming out of different areas. That, along with the tilt, is measured. And the tilt describes how the ground is literally inflating and deflating with pressure that's building up below. And finally, seismic activity, earthquakes. Usually, if an area will start to experience flurries of earthquakes in one specific area, that's probably magma moving up between the rocks.
One final question. Now, what was I looking at last night? You know, where did that lava come from, and what was it doing when it got to the sea to create that plume? And was I actually seeing lava jumping up in the air, or was I just wishful thinking on my part?
You probably were seeing it jump up in the air. Basically, what you were looking at down at the viewing area is you were looking at the ocean entry where the lava has been flowing for approximately 9 miles from its source. And a lot of the time over that span of 9 miles, it's underground. It's in a lava tube. But it'll peak out in places, and you may have seen that as it got darker. You might have seen that popping out on the hillside. But ultimately, it ends up in the ocean, and like I was saying, we're talking about a substance that's about 2,000 degrees, and that 2,000 degrees all of a sudden finds itself in the ocean, which is about 70-something degrees, or, you know. So that's an extreme temperature change, and literally when that lava hits the ocean, it explodes almost immediately. And it explodes into zillions of little grains of sand. That's why we have a lot of black sand beaches on the Big Island of Hawaii. And the explosions that you may have seen could have been land that was building up as this flow has continuously been dumping into the ocean there. And the foundation for that new land is really just this sand. So every now and again, chunks of that land will just fall into the ocean, and it's still somewhat hot. So when it falls in, it explodes. In fact, that's a big thing that we deal with here at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, the bench collapses down at the ocean entries.
Yeah, I was like, I'm sitting there watching this, and I'm thinking, this is how the world began. It was just really, and the crowd was reverential. There was 500 people out there, and most of them were just kind of oohing and on like fireworks, only maybe even a little more.
Yeah, I would say probably a little bit more. I know exactly. I still remember the first time I ever saw lava. And you're right, if you study this kind of thing, if you're studying the earth and you've always read about it and you're not from a place like here, and then you finally get a chance to come to Hawaii and see the lava firsthand, it's almost a spiritual moment. I mean, you're watching the earth form right before your eyes, and everything you've ever read about just kind of comes together, and wow, it's real. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, BG, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you, and... obviously, you're going to stay here quite a while.
Oh, yeah, I don't have any plans to go anywhere right now. But thanks for having me today.
Okay, we're going to speak with David Benitez now. He's a National Park Service ecologist. He works with what happens after the lava falls and the plants want to come back and start living in this rock. Testimony to that, again, I was walking on this only 20-year-old lava last night, looking down in the cracks, and here's these ferns and tiny pieces of moss growing out of this black rock, and it only took about 20 years. So, it's just a testimony to the wonder of life, really, and just kind of was interesting to watch that. So, anyway, David, welcome to Homegrown.
Aloha.
You guys got this aloha thing down pretty well. Okay, let's talk about plant succession. I know you've been here quite a while, and you're doing a lot of work, and you're actually working to restore certain areas higher up the mountain. But let's kind of begin with those ferns I saw and that little moss I saw in those cracks in this black lava. Is that usually where life comes back to the rocks?
Sure. Succession happens in a number of different ways, and it's contingent upon what ecological zone you're in. So one of the prerequisites for life is moisture, but then also plants need something to root into. And in a lot of cases where there is ample moisture, weathering and plant establishment first occurs in these tiny little cracks. And over time, the parent material continues to weather, and you get increasing vegetation development, more ferns, herbs. Eventually, you get shrubs and trees. One of the most notable colonizers here is the Ohia lehua tree as well. And so that's something that you will see on even 40-year-old lava flows where there is adequate moisture.
Yeah, in fact, let's go back to the beginning here, because something like 90% of the plants here on Hawaii are endemic to Hawaii. Talk about that a little bit.
The Hawaiian Islands are unique for a number of reasons, but really, as any biologist will tell you, the degree of endemism that is displayed here, particularly within the plants, is unparalleled anywhere else in the world. 90% of the plants are endemic. What that means is of the native flora, 90% of those species are found nowhere else in the world. That is a testament to Hawaii's isolation from continental land masses, and also the diversity of environments that are represented in Hawaii, where you have everything from shoreline to subalpine and alpine tundra. So over time, over these millions of years, as BG told you about, relatively few seeds, propagules of plants arrived in the islands. The natural rate of establishment was one flowering plant species establishing every 100,000 years. From there, they'd get established and radiate outward, much as Darwin described for the Galapagos. And now we have the unique flora that is the Hawaiian Island flora.
And yet, as it happens in Louisville, with honeysuckle and all over our planet, unfortunately, it's like two-thirds of the plants now in Hawaii were not natives. They're invasives.
Correct. That two-thirds is for Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Of a flora of 950 species, we have over 600 species that are non-native. And that really touches on a bunch of different issues. But like say earlier, you were talking about succession. And we actually have plant species that are coming in at the very first stages of succession, where those lava flows are really young. And they're establishing their preempting resources for, and in so doing, are altering the successional trajectory of that lava flow at the initial stages. And so that's just one concern that we need to be proactive in our management about and try to preserve as natural of a balance as possible.
Yeah, we took a little drive here earlier in the day up on the side of a volcano, an 11-mile trail along which David and the people he works with are literally planting areas to kind of bring it back to the way it was and to fight off these invasive species. Tell us about a couple of those development areas you're working on.
What we toured was the Mauna Loa Strip Road. It's a sector of the park upwards of 4,000 foot elevation. And these are former cattle pastures that we are restoring with native species, including acacia koa, and mamaki shrubs and alii shrubs. And over time, these efforts began about 9 years ago. And what you saw today is dramatically different than the kind of barren, weedy areas that they were when we began the efforts. So we're restoring a forest, supplementing with native species, whether it be outplanting seedlings and saplings or broadcasting seeds.
We were talking earlier, it was kind of gratifying about you and BG and so many park rangers I've met is your sense of purpose in what you do and this overwhelming enemy, so to speak, of the invasives, and yet you feel your work is worthwhile and that you're accomplishing something and you're passing something on for future generations.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think BG would agree, and most people who work in this park feel very fortunate. Not only is the environment entirely beautiful and the people are extremely friendly and great to work with, but really the resources are so unique and so imperiled. And we, on a day-to-day basis, see the results of our actions. So it's very satisfying, and it's very enjoyable work. I feel fortunate and blessed every day.
Well, David Benitez, thank you for what you do and how you feel about our Earth.
Thank you.
David Benitez is an ecologist with the National Park Service. For more information on David or the park, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Coming up next, a few listener questions, another one of Bob's fabulous plant stories. Alava iho oi maka au au Huana ka makani hele ulu ulu Me ola ka peina me ka iona Mena ki ke ala nu. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With wedding bells.
With wedding bells, indeed. Yeah. We have a couple of questions, and one has to do with weddings. This one's from Christine, Bob. She says, hi, I was wondering if you knew of any gardens that can be wedding locations in Louisville. I've always wanted a garden wedding and wanted to see if you knew of any locations. Thanks for your time, Christine.
Yeah, there's several. Historic Homes Foundation has several, I know. Garden Court has it. And, of course, Whitehall has weddings, I know.
Right.
Locust Grove.
Right.
Where else?
Udell has recently started hosting weddings out there, and it's a fabulous garden space. You know, these are the ones, those are the ones that come to my mind in terms of cool spaces, outdoor spaces that have gardens. I also know that some of the wineries, like out towards Lexington, I mean, that's not the Louisville area, but... You know, there are other opportunities, I think, in the rural enclaves of our community that might offer some nice outdoor spaces as well. I would check with those places, Garden Court, Locust Grove, Whitehall, Udell, and check the dates because I think they also book up pretty quickly.
Yeah. And another question, a man named Don Shoring has an interesting question. He wants to grow tomatoes in 5-gallon plastic buckets this spring and summer. Wonders what mix he should use and should he use drain holes? Got to have the drain holes for sure.
Got to have the drain holes
for sure. Yeah, because you're not growing water lilies, you're growing tomatoes.
And tomatoes actually, I mean, hasn't it been your experience, Bob, that tomatoes almost do a little bit better during a dry summer than a wet summer?
Yes.
And they definitely need good drainage. So, definitely drill some holes in the bottom. In terms of a mixture, I would just use good potting soil. And I would try to go to a specialty nursery to get good potting soil because some of that big box potting soil stuff is kind of yucko.
Yeah.
And then you can mix in my favorite kind of composty additive to container, like making my own mixes, is hen manure. So you'll add a little more density to it so it'll retain a little bit more moisture but still drain well because you've got your potting mixture in there. Plus it'll add nutrients so you won't have to fertilize, you know, it'll be a more natural sort of slow release, if you will, form of nutrients. Hen manure is my favorite.
And let us know what happens. Mail us some tomatoes.
There you go.
That'd be great.
And along with any other questions.
Yeah.
That's right.
If you have questions for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Call us at 814-8246 or email us at homegrown@WFPL.org.
All right, Bob, I'm ready for a new chapter of Bob's plant stories.
Bob plant book.
Yeah.
The Red Hot Poker.
All right.
It's a great name for a plant. It's also called the torch lily, and you see it a lot. It can get 3 to 5 feet tall, has these vibrant torch-like flowers, and they come in red and orange and yellow. And we tend to see the reds and the yellows, but there's about 20 or 30 different cultivars you can get. It's closely related to the aloe, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, the foliage tells you that.
Exactly.
It's kind of sharp.
It's temperate climate. It's a native to Africa. There's 70 different species there. And in Africa, it does well in wet areas.
Huh.
It needs good drainage, but a lot of water. It was first brought to England in 1707. So it's got a long history in
colonialism.
The European folks. Yeah.
It's called colonialism.
That's right. Yeah.
Let us not forget.
Sorry. Yeah. You teachers are all alike. It's a good hummingbird plant. They like it a lot. It's not always hardy in this area because... it is the temperate plant, so you got to be careful with it. The Latin name, I've heard a lot of pronunciations. The one I think we can agree on is Nephophia. You tend to want to pronounce the K.
Right, but it's K-N, right?
Nephophia. Yeah, Nephophia, but it's named for a man named Johann Hermannus Niphoff.
Huh.
He was a German professor of medicine who lived from 1704 to 1763. He wrote a book, a 10-volume book called Botanica in Original, which was the first to use plant illustrations created by inking the actual plants.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
So he's worth being named a plant for.
Certainly.
And he did it, yeah. And it was the first time nature printing had ever been used in a publication.
That's like extremely interesting.
Really cool, yeah. And, of course, there's a poem to go with all this.
Oh, good.
Are you bored with your garden oh so plain? Do you yearn for some colors less mundane? Plants that will glow like a torch in a cave. Is that what you so desperately crave? And are you willing to give it a home where water soaks well through the loam? Will you wait the few years it will take to splash color across your landscape? To grow a plant that's a real fire stoker, a queen of hearts, not the proverbial joker, and once established, a very hard worker. then make way for your new red-hot poker.
All right.
Hold the applause until the end of the show.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Excellent. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown next week on the show. Kew Gardens and Preserving the Ethnobotanical Past of Hawaii.
Homegrown is produced by the always clean-shaven Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.